A spectre is haunting Europe, the spectre of communism. All the powers of old Europe have entered into a holy alliance to exorcise this spectre. So begins the introduction of the Communist Manifesto, published by not one but two Jewish intellectuals, Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, in 1848. Now, at some point, that spectre of communism became fused with anti-Semitism in far-right rhetoric. In the imaginations of the far-right, communism was a Jewish plot to overturn the sovereignty of nation-states and to pollute white bloodlines. The Berlin Wall came down in 1989, heavens above, 30 years ago this year. Some of the far-right nationalists today weren't even born then, but I don't think there's a single country in Europe in which a communist party has any real power or much traction. So why has this idea of the Jewish Bolshevik conspiracy become resonant again today in the US and Australia, as well as in Europe? And has the fear of global conspiracy shifted now to Muslims? And what does it mean for an understanding of the way the rhetoric of the far right works? Now, my next guest has set out to answer this in his book, A Spectre Haunting Europe, The Myth of Judeo-Bolshevism. Paul Hannenbrink is Associate Professor of History at Rutgers University in New Jersey. And we welcome you, Paul, to our little wireless program. Can you be kind enough to sketch out the notion of Judeo-Bolshevism?
Yes, and thank you very much for having me. The idea of Judeo-Bolshevism, as I view it, goes beyond this idea that individual Jews have been communists, which of course they were, and deals very much with this idea that Jews as a group are somehow uniquely responsible for communism, and especially for communist crimes, that Jews have somehow some kind of special affinity for communism that other groups don't have, and that therefore Jews as a group should be blamed for communism. It's an idea that you can see from the very first days of the Russian Revolution, and you can see it recurring throughout the 1920s, 1930s, of course, in Nazi ideology during World War II and in those movements and states that collaborated or sympathized with it. As I try to show in the book, continue to have a strange afterlife after 1945, and even, as you noted in your introduction, after 1989.
Well, let's look at a recent manifestation, because you remind us that in 2017 at Chartsville, there was a photo of a white nationalist leader in a demo wearing a T-shirt with the picture of Cornelio Codrino, who was an interwar Romanian fascist.
Yes, and I was really very struck by this. And in fact, it's one of the sort of the puzzles that I'm trying to think about in the book. Clearly there is something about the set of ideas that men like Cornelio Codriano had in the 1930s that are resonant again to the far right today in the United States, as you say, in Charlottesville, and also in many places in Europe. And I think it has to do with the fears that the Romanian fascists in the 30s had that a Jewish plot that was international, that was being communists inside and outside Romania, was somehow undermining Romanian sovereignty. I think the idea of this kind of a secure sovereignty is a theme that you can hear once again very loudly on the far right. And so older fears of ideas and radicals and revolutionaries who might be slipping across the border or working across the border to radicalize dangerous elements at home, and that therefore the borders are not so secure anymore. These ideas, I think, are very much relevant again. And I think that has something to do with the enthusiasm that that demonstrator whom you mentioned has for men like Codriano.
It's interesting, isn't it, that this Romanian fascist is not only popular with neo-Confederates in the US, but with the far right in Poland.
Yeah, I mean, that is a really very remarkable thing, and I think it says something about the ways in which sort of the iconography, the ideology, the set of the ideas, the symbols, and indeed the history of sort of really circulated across borders, because there wasn't this close association at the time in the 1930s between the Romanian far right and the Polish far right. But today in the European far right, there is this kind of shared set of memories that links the ideas of one fascist movement in one country to those in the others. And so, you know, neo-Confederates or rallies in Warsaw or far-right movements in Germany can look at these figures in other countries and feel that they are somehow a part of what it is that they believe and the kind of Europe that they think they want to try to protect. In ways that were different in important ways in the 1920s and 30s.
I'm talking to Paul Hannebrink from Rutgers University about Jewish Bolshevism, and I was saying to him off air before the program started that news came in recently of a vandal's attack on Marx's tomb, or Marx's memorial in Highgate Cemetery in London, which seems appropriate to our discussion. Paul, anti-Semitism, of course, was around for centuries before communism. So what makes Judeo-Bolshevism different from other kinds of anti-Semitism?
Yeah, I mean, you're quite right to say that, and it's something that I try to address in the book. I mean, for me, I think the important thing is to begin by noting, as you did, that it has a very old history and that it's been around for a very long time, but that at particular moments it takes a particular shape or particular form and is associated with a specific set of ideas, and then in another period of time it might change and be attached to other kinds of meanings. A famous historian once described anti-Semitism as a cultural code. And in any given time, I think the task of the historian is to decode what anti-Semitism is about in that instance. And so for me, what is so striking about the Judeo-Bolshevik myth is that for the entirety of the 20th century, in many different places all at once, this unique fusion of communism and Judaism sort of came together to describe certain kinds of political anxiety, certain kinds of political fears. And it crystallized it and captured it in ways that other kinds of anti-Semitic invective or anti-Semitic stereotypes didn't do quite as clearly. And so for that reason, it had such tremendous political power.
As a young Bolshevik, as a teenage communist, I remember being intensely discomforted by the discovery of virulent anti-Semitism in the upper echelons of the Kremlin. That's one slight problem with the logic of the far right. Another is that they see Jews as billionaire controllers of the world's financial systems, manipulating markets for the enrichment of the Jewish cabal. Yet on the other, the Jews are accused of wanting to spread communism, a paradox.
It is, and you know, in the conspiratorial imagination, what seems so clearly a paradox to any kind of logical analysis is easily explained away by a kind of notion that Jews are in some kind of partnership on both sides of that equation to achieve some kind of power. What interests me about the Judeo-Bolshevik myth is that this idea of Jews in power often seen, it kind of relates to a very old idea of sort of, Jews having power as a sort of sign of a dystopia. And so the more you sort of describe what Jews in power might look like, the more fleshed out this dystopian vision of the world is, which allows you to sort of imagine in response to it your own vision of how a society could be well ordered and organically pure and harmonious. And so what you often find in these texts of the far right, where they talk about what they believe the Jewish dominated Soviet Union is like, is sort of a mix of actual facts sort of strung together with their own sort of spin on it to create this vision of a world that is the inverse of the one that they like to fantasize about as being the right one.
I'm talking to Paul Harnabrink about various Jewish conspiracy theories on LNL on RN. And, of course, you can download the show or listen on the ABC Listen app. Paul, one of the ways historians in the past have tried to deal with this issue is to pick through the history. They look at things like how many communists were actually Jews or were Jews overrepresented as party leaders. You respectfully diverge from that approach.
Yes. I think to go down that road has a number of problems. The first is that as a practical matter, from the very beginning, liberals have done precisely that in response to the accusations of far right. They have liberal Jewish groups, but also non-Jewish liberals have counted the number of Jews. They have thought about Judaism and whether, in what ways it was had kind of an affinity with left ideology or not. And they came up with many counterexamples of Jews who weren't communists. And it never seemed to matter. And so for me, the more important question is not, how true was it or is it so? But the question, why is this something that people were continuously fixated on, even after it was shown to be a myth? And so I'm always very much interested in, why have so many people wanted to, in a sense, put the onus on a minority group to demonstrate their loyalty to the society around them, and to count the number of Jews when there isn't the same urge to count other kinds of groups who have been communists at particular times. So for me, it's the logic behind the question, why is the Jewish Bolshevik such a powerful figure? That is the intriguing one and that I think demands the historical attention.
1914 to 23, the years of the First World War, the Bolshevik Revolution, and, let us say, general imperial breakdown in Europe. What are the key things to understand about that period?
The key things to understand is the in Eastern Europe, the sort of broadly, is that, amidst this breakdown of empires and this, furious struggle to sort of establish or defend or expand the borders of nation states, that the idea of the Jewish Bolshevik carried with it not only the sort of threat of revolutionary upheaval, but, was really a kind of very pregnant image of this idea that a national enemy might exist on both sides of the border. There was a lot of concern about Jewish refugees from the pogroms in the former Russian Empire, the Ukraine and elsewhere, fleeing and carrying with them radical ideas which might, infect local populations. And so there was a lot of concern about the circulation of Jews and the ideas that Jews might carry with them, which in turn built upon fears from the First World War of whether or not Jews were in fact loyal to the governments for which they were fighting.
How did fascist movements use this Judeo-Bolshevik mythology in the period between the two world wars?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting question. I mean, because in many of the countries in Eastern Europe and also, for example, in France, the far right has its own ideas about the ways in which the Jewish Bolshevik threatens their ideal of a national community, the integrity of it, the purity of it, the stability and the harmony of it. And at the same time, there is a lot of reflection among these fascist movements about what is happening in Nazi Germany with Nazi ideology and the sort of the idea of what a Nazi-dominated Europe, sort of a Nazi New Order might look like, and the place in which their nations might fit into it. And as those kinds of larger conversations within fascist movements were borne out, the idea of the Jewish Bolshevik also served as a kind of glue or kind of recurring image that allowed, gave substance to the idea that there could in fact be some kind of common enemy that might link these groups together in defense of a European civilization as they understood it.
Let's move now to the defeat of Nazi Germany. These ideas took very strong hold in Eastern Europe. Why?
They took strong hold in Eastern Europe because, for several reasons. There was a very long history of it. These are the reasons where you had, in the aftermath of the First World War, a very strong backlash in many countries. There were far-right movements, far-right parties, far-right governments in many of these places during the war, stirring up a kind of, understanding that the Soviet enemy against which they were fighting was a state dominated by Jews, and that if they won, then the Jewish Bolshevik menace, which they described, would sweep over the country. Not least because the Communist Party, when they came to power, there were very prominent in many countries Jews at the head of it, and they understood quite clearly that they were going to have to grapple somehow with this existing set of ideas about communism being basically Jewish tyranny. And so,
yeah, I remember, for example, Rákosi in Hungary. There were communist Jewish leaders in many Eastern European countries.
Yeah, there were, that's an important thing to understand, because this was the way in which public opinion sort of fixated and understood communist power. At the same time, I would add that there were in the years right after 1945, many Jews who were Zionists who then left. There were Jews who were neither communist nor Zionist who went west and emigrated. As in 1945, as it was in the period right after World War One, it's again this fixation on certain individuals as being a kind of symbol for the entirety, a kind of a false equation that allows someone like Rákosi to become the symbol for Jewish power as such.
It's interesting, isn't it, that in Western Europe, in Allied occupied West Germany, for example, war crimes trials and denazification. But that process also posed problems, because when Nazis were put on trial and punished, local populations saw this as Jewish revenge rather than justice.
I mean, the idea of the war crimes trials being Jewish revenge is something that you see there. You see it very, very strongly in Eastern Europe as well. In West Germany, one of the things that I found very interesting as I did the research is the ways in which certain aspects of the anti-Judeo-Bolshevik ideology that the Nazi regime promoted was sort of remixed, so that after 1945 it might be, for example, on the one hand politically incorrect now to talk about the Soviet Union as a Jewish dominated state, but the idea that was very, very important to Goebbels and to the entire Nazi propaganda machine that the Jewish Bolsheviks were somehow inspiring a mass of Asiatic hordes to come west, that aspect of it remained. It was still very much possible to talk about the Soviet Union as a kind of an Asiatic, un-European, barbaric horde. And so in this way, there is a very strong continuity in rhetoric, even as we can see the obvious political discontinuities with the trials and the collapse of the Nazi regime.
German Christianity, a new Christianity, rather, was emerging in West Germany.
You mean after 1945?
Yeah.
Or, I mean, I think one of the, you know, there's this, the importance of the Christian churches to the reconstruction of West Germany after 1945 just cannot be emphasized enough. And, you know, one of the things that it did, in addition to sort of laying the groundwork for sort of a, you know, pluralist democratic society, was that it also allowed a kind of, you know, Christian anti-communism, the language of a Christian anti-communism, to be a comfortable way for many on the right to sort of, you know, continue understanding the Soviet Union as an enemy to the civilization, just as they had done before the war, but to change their language, the language in which they spoke about it in certain ways. As I said, it was maybe incorrect and impossible publicly to say that Soviet Union was Jewish, but you could certainly call it Asiatic. In the 1950s, and there are many examples of people doing just that.
Now, of course, Christian democracy in Western Germany takes on the American notion of Judeo-Christian values.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's another one of the very interesting sort of surprises, in that there's this really interesting migration of the adjective Judeo. So if before World War II there was this notion that, to, you know, Judeo, talking about Judeo-Bolshevism was a way to be anti-communist. There is, after 1945, the sense that Judeo-Christian civilization is what you are defending against communism, so that the Judeo is now evaluated positively by Christian leaders in the United States and in Western Europe, by politicians, and so forth. But this idea of Judeo-Christian civilization in Western Europe always existed in a kind of interesting symbiosis with older notions of Christian or Western civilization, which could be, you know, in certain hands, sort of carry much more echoes of the time before 1945. And I think that this understanding of communism as a threat, not just to you know, sort of democracy, democratic systems, or to sort of political parties, but to sort of civilization as such, is a language and is a kind of a way of understanding a threat that links the period before World War II to the decades after it.
Paul, how does remembrance of the Holocaust play into the political consciousness in the U.S.?
You know, what this is actually the one of the points that brought me first to this topic, because I was very interested to see language of the right in Eastern Europe in the 1990s, when I was doing my work on my dissertation, that there was such interest in sort of, you know, Jews and communism and the role that Jews had played in communism being somehow relevant to how people remember the Holocaust, or how they should remember the Holocaust. And I think that there is, you know, from, let's say, the 1980s on, maybe the 1970s, there's this kind of sense that remembering the Holocaust is somehow a symbol of a broader set of liberal democratic values, sort of respect for human rights, respect for multiculturalism, respect for pluralism, and that, you know, remembering the Holocaust, commemorating it, writing histories of about the Holocaust is somehow a kind of a civic practice that demonstrates also an allegiance to those wider values. And so, you know, challenging the sort of standard narratives of the Holocaust, in particular by saying, you know, well, we understand that, but we also need to take into account crimes committed by Jews, as a way that the right in Eastern Europe, for example, but also elsewhere in Europe, can push back against what they see as a kind of broader liberal political correctness, as a way of pushing back against a vision of a liberal and cosmopolitan Europe, which they see as being anathema to the sovereignty of their own nations.
The recent vandalism of the Marx Memorial in Highgate reminds me that the term cultural Marxism is now remarkably popular in the rantings of the right. It's even applied to this program for some mysterious reason. Cultural Marxism.
Yeah, I mean, this is an, I would say, the return of this idea of cultural Marxism. I would also say the return of the focus on, you know, George Soros and the NGOs that he supposedly has, you know, woven into a web to sort of control various, the political lives in various countries all at once. This is a sort of a sign to us that, if, you know, the moment in which, you know, the Judeo-Bolshevik myth is no longer politically relevant, because, as you said in your introduction, communist parties are a shadow of what they once were and have no real power, and if the myth is only existing in memory, nonetheless, the kinds of the conspiratorial imagination that fueled it has morphed again, and cultural Marxism and the kinds of antipathies to sort of liberal political discourse that it embodies are now the new form in which this conspiratorial thinking takes shape.
Well, let's end our conversation by raising something you write about, and that is that the ultra-right now has a choice between Jews and Muslims.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that there are very important affinities, and I wanted to end the book with this with these ideas to sort of chew over. That you know, if you think, take for example the shooting at the Pittsburgh synagogue recently, which was so horrible. The shooter blamed Soros and the NGOs for also, you know, bringing in sort of migrants, and he sort of linked this to sort of, you know, Islam and to other sorts of threats. And so there's a way in which the sort of the conspiratorial imagination that fueled the Judeo-Bolshevik myth is also tied, I think, in certain ways, or has a relationship to the ways in which people see Muslim migration as a threat to European civilization. I mean, the language that you hear the far right talk about in debates over migration in Europe as a threat to Christian civilization, as a threat to Christian nations, these are phrases with real histories, and they have a very powerful history in the 1920s and 1930s and 1940s, in which the enemy were not Muslims, but Jews and particularly Jewish communists. And so you see this language being repurposed with a different outsider now, an outsider that's driven with perhaps a different kind of ethno-religious identity, but an ethno-religious identity all the same. And I think that should lead us to sort of think about the kinds of anxieties and fears that are driving the far right. Because the fears, for example, for sort of the sovereignty of the nation, for the integrity of the national community, these kinds of anxieties have deep roots, and they weren't just produced in the last few years.
Thank you very much, Paul. Paul Hannebrink, his book is called A Spectre Haunting Europe, The Myth of Judeo-Bolshevism, published by Harvard University Press.